Hey, everybody. As I record this, there continue to be protests against police brutality and anti-blackness of all sorts, frankly, in the streets of over 140 cities around the country. And that is both inspiring and uplifting to see and terrifying to see the images that are coming out of it. We on our editorial team are having trouble making it through meetings without bursting into tears. And I just want to acknowledge that that might be where a lot of you are when you listen to this too. We are there with you. But we are also continuing to think about all of the work we have to do as a society, all of the baggage we carried into this COVID-19 crisis. A few weeks back, we talked about mass incarceration. Scroll down in your feed and check that out if you missed it. But suffice to say, almost none of the stuff that we do to control the spread of this virus is happening behind bars. So there's been a movement to get people out of those facilities, and that movement has seen some success. But the success begs a whole new question. What then? What if we totally empty jails and prisons? What happens to all those people who had been hidden away in cages? That's the question we're asking in this episode, and it turns out a huge share of them will remain captive to choices we made as a society decades ago. I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future. A huge number of people who are locked up in this country are mentally ill or addicted to drugs, or both. Depending on how you calculate it and where you live, it's anywhere from 20% to more than half.
Oh, yeah, the first name, cool. My name is Jermaine.
Jermaine is one of those people. He's a 36-year-old man in Cleveland, Ohio, who is diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, among other things. He's also one of about 900 people who county officials rushed to process and release from jail starting back in March.
I knew they was trying to stop it from spreading, so they were letting people out. That's how I got out.
Jermaine's illness is essentially why he was in jail in the first place. It's true for a startling number of people, actually. They're locked up for things they did because they weren't getting treatment. Because there is essentially no safety net for people with mental illness or addiction problems in this country. Over the past several decades, the United States has instead foisted responsibility for this issue primarily on the shoulders of our criminal justice system, often to terrible ends. A police encounter with someone with a mental illness is so much more likely to go horribly wrong, especially if they are Black or if they are a person of color. In some counties, prisons are the largest providers of mental health care. Just think about that for a minute. More than hospitals or any other institution, it's prisons. So what happens when those inmates, patients, really, what happens when they get released? For Jermaine, the first thing he did when he got out of jail was to vanish onto the streets of Cleveland.
I was supposed to go to the treatment center, but they just let me out. They just scrapped all that, and it was just me. Just, I had to do on my own. Messed up, for real. It just was messed up.
Our reporter, Marianne McCune, has spent weeks following a psychiatrist and a social worker as they try to find Jermaine and others like him and help them survive on the outside and hopefully to flourish. Marianne takes the story from here.
A lot of us have someone in the family or someone close who is addicted to drugs or has some kind of mental illness, manic episodes or paranoia. They can't keep out of trouble, and we can't figure out how to take care of them. Those are the kind of people who end up in Dr. Testa's office.
Hi, Marianne. It's Meg Testa, psychiatrist from Cleveland.
Since I can't go see her myself,
I'm at the agency. I'm outside.
Dr. Testa has been recording dispatches from her office. And it's down to every little detail.
I'll be using this to call my patients.
Dr. Testa is a psychiatrist for people who churn in and out of the criminal justice system. So as they come out of Ohio's prisons and jails, she tries to keep them from going back in. When the county released those 900 people from jail back in March, that was a full one-third of the inmates there, all of them released over a period of about 3 weeks, an unprecedented rate. And since then, Dr. Testa's work has been more chaotic than ever.
I'm like in my office trying to call a patient. I'm hanging it up and my desk phone rings. And it's one of my patients that was my patient 2 years prior. And he had just been let out of a jail with no meds, no treatment, no nothing, and told to just give a promise to link up with his doctor. He did call me, but by this time, he was calling me to tell me how many banks he owned and how much money he had and how great he was doing because he was fully manic.
Dr. Testa has blurred some of the details of the case to protect his identity. She says there's no way a person in his state could consent to sharing his story. And she's giving him the name Bobby.
He was on the bus when he was on the phone with me. He's using drugs and alcohol. He's without treatment. He doesn't really think he needs treatment. He doesn't even know how to keep himself safe from coronavirus because he thinks the whole thing is like a trick by the government and it's martial law and it's a whole lot of nothing that he needs to be worried about.
Dr. Testa says this call from a bus, this is not the way to get started with a patient. If you want any chance of helping someone begin a new life after prison, you need to start the minute they walk out that gate. That is the precarious moment, that transition between a life where almost everything is decided for them to a life where the decisions are theirs. And what's missing right now more than ever is a handoff from the jail or prison to the people who can help.
The problem is that if we don't even know that they're out, we're going to lose them.
At this point, Bobby has had weeks on the street without medication, making choices that could hurt him.
How are you coping?
And all Dr. Testa can do is wait for his calls.
Any fever or coughing, anything like that? Trouble breathing? A lot of our patients, they don't have families to come back to. They don't have a lot of people in their lives. So it's possible that I'm just the only person in his life that he can think of that'll pick up the phone and talk to him right now.
I spend the next several weeks checking in to see how those conversations are going.
Good. Tell me about
Dr. Testa's goal to somehow coax him off the bus, off the streets, and into her office for help.
I know. We miss you, too.
Dr. Testa is part of a team of doctors and counselors and caseworkers whose mission is to help people with mental health problems exit the criminal justice system.
Good morning.
She works for Recovery Resources, one of a network of agencies that contract with the state and county to set up housing, health care, rehab, ideally the moment a person is released.
They'll pick him up. They'll try to get his income sorted out. They'll take him to family services. They'll try to get him food stamps. They'll take him shopping. They'll get him clothing. They'll help him apply for jobs.
But since COVID-19, they've had to pull back dramatically to comply with Ohio's shutdown order.
Good morning. How are you?
The waiting room here is normally full of people.
There's only one person there, kind of sitting in the corner wearing a mask.
Just a few of them come to the office at a time. The rest are on the phone or a computer screen.
Do you guys want to say hi? Nobody's saying hi.
They will. They're all muted.
Oh, okay.
Say hi. It's a reporter for that thing I'm doing.
Radio.
Annette Amistadi is a social worker Dr. Testa works closely with.
We have Dawn, the nurse.
She's also been recording herself while she spends a frustrating amount of time searching for the people she's supposed to be helping.
Did he give you the address?
Yeah.
I don't think we've had anybody.
Right now, she's trying to find Jermaine, the guy with schizoaffective disorder who was among the hundreds released in haste after COVID hit.
So it is 11:48. It's Annette here trying to locate a client who was released from city jail without a plan, and I wasn't aware of his release. So now I am trying to figure that out. So I'm going to send this email now.
Jermaine was Annette's client last year when he came out of a longer stint in prison. They were making some progress, trying to treat his addiction and prescribing psych medication, but as is often the case, he got locked up again. She was waiting for information about his court dates and release, and then she found out, oh, he's been out for a week and a half. His parole officer emailed saying she has no idea where he is.
He is declared whereabouts unknown. but I'm hopeful that, I don't even know, we can find something, because he definitely needs help, and this is a problem. So that's currently what I'm doing.
Over the weeks to come, Annette will be part social worker, part detective. Her mission? Find Jermaine and pull him into the fold. While down the hall, Dr. Testa is waiting for that desk phone to ring, with Bobby on the other end. She's especially worried about getting Bobby the right medication in time.
He's one of those guys that, like, he has a different treatment when he's in prison than he has when he's on the street.
This is something I'd never thought about, but mentally ill people are like all of us in that they behave differently in different settings. So Dr. Testa says a lot of her patients will have their prison meds and their street meds.
An example of that is called Zyprexa. Zyprexa is an antipsychotic medication, and it's really sedating. Some of my patients, they go, Zyprexa, that's my jail med. They feel like they can cope with their environment. They're more calm. They're less likely to overreact to other inmates and get in trouble and get in the hole if they're like a little bit sedated while they're in jail. But as soon as they hit the streets, they say, I'm not taking Zyprexa, that's jail meds. I want Abilify. It treats psychosis, but Abilify doesn't usually cause sedation. And so people will tell me, like, I need to be alert. I need to be able to watch my back. I need to be able to react.
Right now, Dr. Testa knows exactly what's going to help Bobby on the street, because she's treated him in the past. A strong dose of an antipsychotic drug, an injection that lasts him for a month at a time.
I can say, like, we know you need your shot. Come on in and get your shot. But right now, when he's so grandiose and he's so amped and he's so into his delusions, and it's hard to come at him that way.
And every day he's out there without treatment, he's harder to reach. As the weeks pass and I listen to Dr. Testa and Annette chase after people everyone else seems to have forgotten about, it's hard not to wonder if people like Bobby and Jermaine are any safer on the streets than they were in jail. And the bigger question, why are those the only two choices in front of them? It's not like no one has noticed that prisoners with mental illness and addiction need help when they get out. In Ohio, both the state and county are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on programs to identify them before they get out and try to link them up with the people who can help. The problem is, success rides on a patchwork system. It depends on what prison or jail you're in, who evaluates you, the judge who presides over your hearing, your parole officer, the program you're signed up for, your social worker.
It's Annette. It is currently 2:02.
While she continues to look for Jermaine, Annette sends me updates about other cases she's working on, too. And there's this one that gives you an idea of the lengths to which she can go to smooth the way for someone when she knows ahead of time they're coming out.
I have an email from the institution where one of my clients who's getting out on Friday.
She's already done the hard part. She has a treatment plan and a group home in Cleveland. But now there's this minute detail of just how to get the woman from the prison 3 hours away to her new home.
They're not able to transport people.
The parole officer tells Annette they're putting her on a Greyhound bus.
So I'm like, okay, well, what time's the bus going to get back in here, like to Cleveland? The bus isn't even getting in here until like 11:30 at night. What the hell am I supposed to do to help somebody at 11:30 at night? How am I going to get her from the bus station in Cleveland to her group home, which is not close? This makes no freaking sense. To send someone on the Greyhound who's already been identified of having mental health issues, like, let's put them on a bus and say, figure it out. Like, what?
So Annette, who I should say is also a member of the National Guard, she did a tour in Afghanistan. She's kind of unstoppable. She keeps emailing and calling prison staff, the parole officer, trying to get an answer from the warden. And 2 days later, here she is.
Hey, it's Annette. It is currently 11:57 on Friday.
Driving to meet her client, and it's noon, not midnight, as originally planned.
She is getting transported up here by the officer.
Continue straight. Then stay to the left to I-77 North downtown.
Which is really awesome. Thank you, GPS. And so now I'm, like, rushing to get there. Like,
Annette got the warden to agree to send the woman to Cleveland in one of the prison's big white cargo vans and to give Annette an ETA. So she's timed things so exactly that she thinks she sees the van driving right behind her.
I have good timing.
Apparently, I am a miracle worker.
Turn right on Buckeye Road.
I'm not sure how I made that work. Being nice or being persistent, I'm not really sure.
By the end of the day, Annette's client has moved safely from prison to a group home. Annette gives her a toothbrush and toothpaste, soap and shampoo, and an appointment to come to the clinic. Annette can't guarantee anyone success, and especially not during a global pandemic. Right now, she can't drive people places, and many of the buildings she would take people are closed anyway.
And then I'll put her in speaker.
She and Dr. Testa have this one client they are really proud of, given the challenges of the moment.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, it's Annette.
Hi.
I am here with the client we're here to interview.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Glenn is 57 years old, a longtime heroin and cocaine addict.
I've got 7 prison numbers with 31 years in prison. I've been diagnosed bipolar with schizoaffective and antisocial personality disorder.
He's got a room in a halfway house, and he says the residents are all washing their hands and keeping a distance.
I'm sitting in my sober house dining room at this moment.
Dr. Testa told me that if everything were normal right now, Glenn would be at her clinic for hours on end in group and individual counseling, AA, in education.
He'd be doing that 4 hours a day, 5 days a week. He would be dropping urine. And it sounds like a little thing, but just knowing that you're going to provide a urine sample, that gives a lot of people what they need to stay sober sometimes. It's like so many factors that go into keeping people clean.
I really just got sober, and now all meetings are stopped, so we don't go to no meetings. You know, you can listen to a meeting on TV or something like that, but it's still not the same because you don't have that closeness. You don't have that, you know, camaraderie of people working together and building friendships and things that you need to stay sober, you know. I mean, it's hard.
He's been trying to keep himself quietly busy. He spends a lot of his time on something he learned to do in prison, gluing matchsticks and popsicle sticks together, one by one, to build these intricate jewelry boxes.
Tell me your favorite thing that you've ever made.
I think the favorite thing I ever made is I made my mom a big ranch house. You know, the windows would slide out. Well, the windows was like a drawer. They would slide out, and she could put her spools of thread and stuff in there.
Now he's making one for Annette and Dr. Testa's office. Every once in a while, Glenn has asked for a face-to-face appointment, but it's complicated.
What it looked like when I saw him in person was he had to wear a mask. Our team needed to drive and drop a mask off at his sober house, so he had a mask.
Dr. Testa is having to think about some of the things we're all thinking about these days. Like, how do you communicate to people with a mask on your face? Except when you're seeing psych patients, the stakes are a lot higher.
I'm trying to extra smile at him so maybe he can see it in my eyes, or maybe he could see it some way or hear it in my voice.
Glenn is doing well now, but a year ago, he was lost. Dr. Testa says he was another case where, despite his mental illness, prison officials released him without an adequate plan or program. She says it's likely they concluded he could connect himself up with what he needed.
They could have felt like, hey, this guy can do it on it. He can link himself up. He can speak for himself. We don't have to link him.
They handed me $75 and a piece of paper that says report to my PO the next working day.
It wasn't until he slit his wrists and tried to commit suicide more than half a dozen times that he found his way to Annette and Dr. Testa.
When you're hopeless and you feel hopeless, you do hopeless things.
If he had been released now and he was in a different place in his recovery, I would guarantee you he would not be doing well right now, and I don't know if he would be alive right now.
Glenn actually agrees with Dr. Testa about that. And he worries about all the people who are getting out right now.
What's been your reaction?
My reaction is they're in trouble. If for the guys like now that are getting kicked out of prison, basically, with this coronavirus, they can't get in no place. There's no place they can go.
Hey, it's Annette. It is right around 11 o'clock.
Annette is still trying to track down Jermaine 12 days after he was released from jail. And then, out of the blue,
he called me today. Yay! I'm so excited. And I'm going to go try to see him today at the shelter. I'm really hopeful he is there. But yeah, just was really excited. Wanted to share that.
He has found his way to a homeless shelter, managed to get a cell phone that he called her on.
Okay, that's the end.
And the next day...
I'm going to take it off speakerphone right now. I'm going to hand the phone.
Just
Jermaine.
She actually manages to meet up with him and find out the full story of what happened.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Annette has known Jermaine for a while. Last year, when he came out of prison the first time around, she and Dr. Testa did a lot for him. They set him up right away with an ID, applied for Social Security. He tried living with his mom in public housing, but caused too much trouble, and she had to kick him out or risk being kicked out herself. Annette was still trying to get him into the right program, but in March, Jermaine says he broke into a liquor store for a drink.
I had caught a break-and-entry case, and I got locked up, and they was letting people out.
With COVID hitting jails and prisons, the county was trying to move people through fast.
They was trying to stop it from spreading, so they was letting people out with lower-tier felonies. They were letting people out or reducing their bonds, so that's how I got out.
And when they said they were going to let you out, did they ask you, hey, do you have any mental illness or addiction problems, or do you have a place to stay? Did they check with you about that stuff?
Yeah, they know. Yeah, they had records of it. The social worker come talk to me about it and ask questions. And they gave me medication to leave. They gave me prescription. I got filled. It's enough for 2 weeks, I think, 2-3 weeks.
And they knew you didn't have a place to stay either.
Yeah. I was supposed to go to the treatment center.
But then...
they just let me out. They just scrapped all that. And just it was just me. Just I had to do on my own. So I went to 2100 Lakeside.
2100 is a shelter?
Yeah, I was in there before, so... that's where I knew where it was at.
So they let you out of jail early because of social distancing, but then you had to go to a shelter where that was impossible?
Yeah. There's no way to practice social distancing in a homeless shelter.
Were you sober when you came out? And then were you able to stay that way? Or?
Yeah, but for a little while. Then it went back to the same thing.
What did you do?
With as far as drugs and alcohol,
yeah.
PCP, crack, alcohol, that is how it is if you're dealing with things. Go back to what you used to.
All right, it's Annette, right around 1 o'clock.
That first visit with Jermaine, Annette checks in from her car after they see each other.
It is like 39 degrees, and of course my feet are like freezing. He is bundled up because, of course, he has no clothing because when you go to jail, you lose all your clothing. And before that, he was at his mom's. And of course, she threw all that away because she's sick of him. And so... had to look into places that he can go get clothing on his own because I can't take him to get clothing, which is just a pain in my ass. He lost his ID. He lost all of the stuff we spent the last year getting him because he did some really stupid stuff. But now I have to go figure out how I'm going to get him in to see the doctor, get his meds figured out, get all that other stuff figured out because now that I located him, I kind of have to start all over.
Annette has to crank things back up to speed again, just as everything around her is grinding to a halt. But there is one piece of good news.
He told me that the shelter is putting him in a hotel tomorrow. So I did not know this, but the shelter is putting people in hotels because they can't social distance and stuff down here, which is pretty freaking awesome. So fingers crossed, he calls me tomorrow like he's supposed to. And then I guess we'll go from there. Now on to the next person.
Annette is so persistently hopeful. But the next time she tries to get in touch with Jermaine, his phone line is dead.
The telephone number you have dialed is temporarily not in service.
A few days later, he leaves a voicemail. He's in the hotel the shelter moved him into.
Getting in the elevator here to see if I can find him.
She gets to his door.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is Jermaine in this room?
He's not here.
He's not there? Okay. All right, thank you. Mind if I just push the down button really quick?
Oh, go ahead.
Excuse me.
Coming up, one more visit to the hotel to find Jermaine. So Jermaine is missing again. And the no-win situation he's facing, this choice between unsafe incarceration and unsafe freedom, it was set up for him and for millions of other people by choices we made as a society decades ago. One of those choices was to shut down a system of state hospitals for the mentally ill, hospitals that had initially been designed in part to get people with mental illness out of jails, but by the 1960s, had come to look a lot like crappy prisons and jails themselves.
The conditions ended up being deplorable, where there was moldy food and individuals with mental illness struggling next to things like rats and other types of vermin. You know, many people crowded into one room and people dying and no one knowing. It really got quite awful.
Patrick Runnels was a psychiatrist for the homeless for almost a decade. Now he's got a bigger title.
The chief medical officer for population health, behavioral health for University Hospitals of Cleveland.
Which means his job is focused on trying to fix the same problems people were trying to solve back when they were shutting down those squalid mental health wards. The plan, and this was under the Kennedy administration, it was to replace those state hospitals with a set of community mental health centers.
Places where individuals with severe mental illness would be able to go and access all of the services in one place that would help them most successfully integrate into society.
Federal officials mapped out this idyllic vision of around 2,000 centers all across the country where people with mental illness could have all of their needs met.
With the idea that states would jump at the opportunity and that this would be a very natural transition that everyone would be very excited to do. It turned out they were wrong.
State and local governments just didn't prioritize turning this system into a reality. They used the money they saved on those mental wards for other stuff. And the federal funding soon vanished. Some patients were able to go home and live with their families. But by the time of the economic recession in the 1970s, a lot of families were struggling themselves. In places like Cleveland and across the Rust Belt, thousands of factory jobs disappeared, and many of them were jobs that were held by Black people, people who had moved north as part of the Great Migration. Now they were living in a socially and economically isolated environment in neighborhoods far away from the family and community networks that had held them and supported them in the South. And here's the thing, unemployment and poverty and racism, it is its own kind of trauma. A kind of trauma that Runnels says leads to mental health and addiction problems. Think about heroin and crack and the drug epidemics that washed over our cities in the 70s and 80s.
You had economics colliding with merging fault lines around race, colliding with a lot of drive from suburban constituencies to ensure that law and order was a major priority. And so all of these trends led to the criminalization of addiction and the criminalization of poverty.
Three strikes, you're out. Harsh drug laws, what we called broken windows policing, all this stuff where all these low-level crimes are getting people arrested and locked up.
So all of these things come together, and what do you think is going to happen to people who have the most trouble and the least social connection?
You're going to get thrown in jail. Which brings us back to Marianne McCune and the people in Cleveland who are trying to help those with mental illness once they're out.
Dr. Testa has a close family member with mental illness who, like so many, ended up behind bars. She remembers sending letters to the prison when she was a child. So, as she puts it, she has a heart for this work. But it's hard. She has to lean heavily on that patchwork of people trying to fix little individual problems in a bigger broken system.
Take two deep breaths together.
Even in her personal life.
Inhale. Exhale.
She does yoga every morning in her attic, and her teacher is a municipal court judge she knows.
Let's bow together and say namaste.
Namaste.
In the courtroom, he sees many of the same people Dr. Testa sees later in her office.
A wonderful, amazing, powerful day.
So the moment they finish their meditation, they start trading work notes.
Yeah. Let me know about your lady. You know, if you put her on probation, you could sort of make a condition. That
downstairs, before Dr. Testa leaves for the office.
I'm going to take my temperature.
Thermometer in her mouth.
That's yours, isn't it?
She lets her son pick out a mask to match her outfit.
This one.
Okay, 97. I'm good to go. He chose a little bit of like a purple mask.
Uh-oh. Can you come get the kitty, baby? Can you come? We got
it. No, don't even think about it.
You got her?
I got you.
Okay, all right. I love you, buddy.
Bye, mommy.
So, like, you're trying to reply for all this stuff, and everything's, like, pretty much, boom, closed.
It's been almost a month since Dr. Testa was sitting here in her office, and that former patient called her out of the blue from a bus, high on delusions about owning several banks.
I know. It's like anything you try to do right now.
He called a lot after that, and she started using what they call motivational interviewing to try to get him to come see her in person, which he finally did for a first appointment.
Yeah, I would love to see pictures. Whenever you can come in the next time, it'll be, like, great.
She says by that time, he'd already gone from that manic state to something much less happy.
We call it dysphoric. It's like this irritable, paranoid state where whereas he had told me, like, that coronavirus was no big deal, it was like a fake thing that the government was putting out there and it wasn't even really a harm to him, he started really, like, fixating on that it was still fake, but that it was sort of reflective of this, like, religious war that was going to happen, and there was Wiccans involved. And what I said was, I said, I remember that you had some of these ideas in the past, and I could be wrong, but it's my recollection that when you took Risperdal, you started to think, like, why was I even thinking that? Like, why was I even feeling that way? And so he was willing to take, like, a light dose of the Risperdal, and so I was able to start that medication for him.
It's currently 3:52.
Annette, the social worker, is still so frustrated by what she's not allowed to do because of COVID. She keeps sending dispatches from her car venting about this or that challenge.
Turn left on St. Clair Avenue.
Here I am debating, do I get in trouble and transport somebody when the agency says I'm not allowed to because of the 6-foot rule thingy, right? Or do I do it to ensure my client's taken care of?
One encouraging development,
she
has managed to talk to Jermaine again and set up a time to meet back in that hotel room the shelter moved him into.
Put on my mask. All right, here we go. Fingers crossed. I'm hoping. I'm truly hoping.
She heads up in that same elevator.
The smell of marijuana is like super potent, so this is fun.
And then she's outside Jermaine's room again.
See how this goes.
I hear something.
Yay.
Hey, Jermaine. How are you?
Jermaine. She's finally found him.
So you got your own room then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Jermaine has a full-size bed to himself. He's got no roommate right now. There's a TV on a stand. And when they call on Annette's phone, Jermaine tells us he's been turning to a channel that, when you think about it, is either terrible or wonderful for someone like him. HGTV, home renovation shows.
The Scott Brothers, or Property Brothers, or watch that. How to build the houses and how they do the houses and stuff.
Oh, like the home improvement things?
Yep, I like to watch Chopped. I love that show.
I don't cook for shit, Jermaine, but I like to watch it.
Meals are delivered to Jermaine's door every day. Lunch comes while Annette's there.
Lunchtime!
It's a mishmash. There's a tub of peanut butter, piece of peach cobbler. In the fridge, Jermaine has a big hunk of orange cheese they brought one day.
What is that? A whole thing of cheese.
They gave us this yesterday. We
like,
left it.
What are you supposed to do with that? That's like, what, a pound of cheese? I don't know, 2 pounds of cheese?
That's what I said.
Well, you know what? I know it's weird, but it's food. Yeah. You know?
Now that Annette has found Jermaine, she's lining things up for him, starting with his Social Security application so he can have some income. But Jermaine is stressed out. He just doesn't know what's coming. The world outside is still mostly shut down. He doesn't have a phone, says someone took it. And honestly, he says life felt easier when he was locked up.
Yeah, you ain't got that many worries in there. You don't have to worry about the clothes or nothing like that.
So does it feel harder now than when you were in
jail? Yeah.
What's better about it?
You ain't got to know the pressures. You know what's coming to you and stuff like that, as far as you ain't got to worry about nothing.
Mm-hmm. When they told you that you were going to get out early from jail, what was your feeling about that?
You got to go back to struggling and stuff. So,
would you have ever told them that you wanted to stay in?
No, you can't. Yeah, I do. Try, you can't.
You did try?
They ain't about to let you do that. You can't do that.
When Dr. Testa first became a forensic psychiatrist, she says she used to congratulate new patients.
Like, they would have their first visit with me being released from jail or prison, and I would be like, how awesome that you're out. Like, I would just come right out of the gate with that. And for a lot of people, it is not awesome that they're out.
Dr. Testa is a big advocate of prison reform. She is definitely on the side of, we should not be locking so many people up, especially people with mental health problems. But given the way the system works now, she's finding herself at odds with people saying this is the moment for change.
It feels really bad to be like, guys, I can't be with you on this one. I think it's a bad idea. I wish that COVID was this golden moment and this is the time and now we're going to decarcerate everyone. That would be really awesome. We should have already been looking at this. We should have already been decarcerating. This is long overdue. We should already be doing this. But to want to do it at warp speed in the middle of a pandemic, that's where I get frustrated, because it's hard enough when someone comes out. And right now is just not the time. It's a really vulnerable place to put people with mental illness and addiction right now. It's a really sad thing to have to say, and I think it's I think it feels really bad as a society right now that we have all these people vulnerable, and now we have a pandemic, and now we're having to look at all that. But I don't think a lot of people are looking at, like, oh, this is what's best for this person. Like, let's get them out. If we were thinking about it that way, we would already done this.
The county jail that so many of Dr. Testa's patients come out of, it's a rough place. In 2018, 8 inmates died there. A U.S. Marshals report called the conditions, quote, inhumane.
It is a despair-inducing environment that is, I wouldn't wish on anybody.
Patrick Runnels has visited the jail, stood in one of the concrete cells where they hold inmates who have gotten in trouble, which mentally ill inmates often can't help but do.
It's about 6x8 with a bed that's basically made out of concrete itself. And you spend 23 of 24 hours of every day in that cell. That 1 hour that you get out of that cell block is typically in a larger population of individuals who have been in and out of jail their whole lives. And if you are vulnerable, it is an easy place to get traumatized verbally and physically.
But from his years as a psychiatrist for the homeless, Patrick also agrees with Dr. Testa that if those traumatized inmates come out of jail without the help they need,
individuals go back into the terrible circumstances from whence they came.
The county jail in Cleveland says its policy is to send inmates out with the medication and the connections they need. And listen, it's not that some prisons at least aren't trying here, but it's still just that patchwork approach. And the long-term challenge, it's kind of the same as it was 50 years ago, the last time we tried to fix this system. Back then, the goal was to get the mentally ill out of state hospitals and get the money out too, to spend it on stuff like housing and basic healthcare. Now, the goal, again, is to get the mentally ill out of jails and prisons and redirect that money. It's not too different from that plan back in the Kennedy era, an integrated network of care across the country.
The wisdom that they were trying to impart was you have to have good circumstances, you have to have the right resources, and those resources have to be readily accessible. And if you don't have that, then things will go badly. So let's have those.
Yes, let's have those. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. This episode was reported and produced by Marianne McCune. It was edited by Christopher Wirth and mixed by Mike Cruz. Our executive producer is Karen Froman. Our team also includes Emily Boteen, Jenny Casas, and Vera Lynn Williams, with help this week from Michelle Harris and Kim Nowaki. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Please do keep in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And thank you for listening. Please take care of yourselves. We'll talk soon.
The United States of Anxiety's health coverage is supported in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health that ensures everyone in America has a fair and just opportunity for health and well-being. More at rwjf.org.